Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And it is Monday at 1 o'clock, which means it is time for all things political. We have a lot to talk about. We'll spend some time this hour talking about the president's relationship with the press and vice versa. The president was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania over the weekend and blasted the press at a campaign-style rally there. And simultaneously, the Washington correspondents, D.C. Correspondents, White House correspondents, dinner was taking place in Washington, and a comedian there had some pointed words for the president and also for the press. So we will look at that. North Korea, of course, remains in the news with the president saying on Face the Nation over the weekend that we could have a major, major confrontation with North Korea, although he hopes that diplomacy will work. We will discuss that this hour. What are the health care plans? Round two for the Republicans. We will discuss that this hour. Also, the tax plan. We will look at the invitation to the Philippines president to come to the White House. Evidently, he said no, but we'll talk about why the president would invite him and many other topics of conversation, whatever you would like to put on the table this hour. We would love to hear from you. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. And our guest is Professor Emily Beaulieu, an associate professor of comparative politics at the Department of Political Science at the University of Kentucky. She is an advisory member of Women Also Know Stuff, a database of female political scientists and experts. And before we get rolling with this hour, I do want to thank the many of you. We had a really large turnout for the League of Women Voters WPR Polarization Divide Forum on Saturday morning at the Whitefish Bay Library. A large number of you participated, and also you were part of small group discussions looking at how to bridge and how to tackle the polarization divide in the country. It was really democracy at its finest, and we thank you for attending. It was good. Thanks also to Erin Richards, great reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She covers education, for co-moderating. It was a good day, and there will be more on that issue to come. Our number, again, 800-486-8655. Feel free to join us. Professor Beaulieu, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Kathleen, thank you so much for having me, and kudos to your work with the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, thanks. It was just, you know, it was one of those days where you felt that people really wanted to take on an issue that is so important in the country right now. We are so divided, aren't we?
It's true. It's true. Polarization is at a record high, both in terms of the legislature and in the electorate more generally.
What did you make of, let's start with what happened on Saturday night. The president was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, giving what many have described as really a campaign rally kind of event. And then you had the Washington Correspondents' Dinner taking place, and we're going to play a couple clips from both of those events, which really show you where the divide is, and it's a divide on so many levels. What was the president doing, being at another campaign rally? He doesn't run again for a long time.
Question, but it's pretty consistent with the approach that we've seen since he took office, both in terms of style and substance. He's clearly planted his flag on a contentious relationship with the press that, based on evidence we have from polling, seems to be resonant, particularly with Republicans, right? Gallup found this past year that trust in the media was at a record low, even though it's been in decline for quite a while, among Republicans, at a record low for Republicans. And so I think we're seeing that on display with the rally in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it's at a record low, Emily?
That's a really good question that I think we know that part of what's happened with the increasing political polarization, right, what we learn from social psychologists is that people have a real tendency to sort of seek out information that reinforces
yes.
their political beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've seen a sort of polarization of media sources. And we've then seen, how can we put this, rhetoric from media sources around sort of the trustworthiness of those on the other side. And that seems to have resonated more with Republicans for whatever reasons. We have seen a decline among Democrats and independents as well. So there is a more global trend, but it's been sharpest with Republicans.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking to your students in the classroom, and some of them may ask you, what should I watch to make sure I get a balanced view of all that's going on in the world? Do you recommend that they watch Fox News and then the next night they watch MSNBC? Do you recommend certain websites, certain newspapers? How do you get a complete picture of where the truth is?
Yeah, it's a great question because, of course, selfishly as an academic, this is one of my biggest concerns right now, right? If we can't agree on how we identify information that's truthful to evaluate critically, I mean, what's our starting point? And so I don't actually recommend any TV news sources to my students. I recommend, first and foremost, I think my hope is to give them the confidence to critically evaluate material they get from any source. I myself personally am a fan of, well, a couple of news sources actually, in particular ProPublica, that does a lot of in-depth reporting, and that, I believe it's a credible source of information because it was very critical of the Obama administration. So it doesn't seem to have a partisan leaning. I also am a really big fan of Teen Vogue. It's done some excellent reporting.
I've heard. I haven't looked at that site yet.
Yeah.
It's good, huh?
They're wonderful. They do great. And they are big fans of Women Also Know Stuff.
I'll have to check out that site. There was a poll done. There are a lot of polls being done, but I thought that this was really interesting, and I want to tie it into a question of whether or not President Obama should have accepted $400,000 to speak at a Wall Street firm. It seems like nobody can get along without Wall Street these days. But this poll that was done recently showing that more people say the Democratic Party is out of touch with ordinary voters than the Republican Party is. And maybe this is a case in point when you have Democrats, Hillary Clinton's certainly, and now Barack Obama taking huge amounts of money to speak to Wall Street firms. Why do you think the poll shows that kind of result? Why do people feel that the Democrats are out of touch with the ordinary people?
That's a great question. I think sentiment that I have heard around analysis of events since the election and since Trump has taken office have to do with the fact that there seems to be a sentiment from both more moderate and more liberal individuals that the Democrats seem to be missing a real opportunity here. That there is sort of, we see in the marches that have taken place around a variety of issues, the climate march this past weekend, the March for Science, the Women's March, what we have seen with social justice movements like Black Lives Matter, the groundswell support for Bernie Sanders, right? There's this sense that there are large swaths of Americans who are not necessarily supportive of Donald Trump and what he stands for. And yet, the Democrats don't seem to be offering leadership or policy platforms that are able to capture that discontent, that are able to sort of harness it in a meaningful way. And I think that's what we're picking up with these polls.
These marches, I got to tell you, I haven't seen anything like this since the days of Vietnam marches many, many years ago. I mean, the numbers were as high as 200,000 people for the climate march. And then just the weekend before, the March for Science was huge. There were 60,000 people in Chicago alone. The Women's March was very large. These marches, you wonder if they're going to let up, but they keep going full force on different issues weekend after weekend.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with all of that discontent?
That's a really good question, and it's one that folks in both political science and sociology have spent time thinking about. What can come of this kind of popular demonstration? And so we have folks like Jacqueline van Stekelenburg, who's a professor in Amsterdam, who thinks about the ways that both there's a disruptive component to these marches, right? They force people to pay attention. They fill up the streets. They chant. They have slogans. That itself can have some power to change the political agenda, right? To say this is something important that needs to be paid attention to now. But there's also a sort of awareness-raising informational component that goes along with these marches. And some scholars have argued that that is actually the more valuable component of protest movements, is their ability to communicate information and persuade citizens and policymakers of a particular viewpoint. You have folks like Abhinav Gupta at the University of Washington Business School, who's done some work on this that argues it really is the informational component of these protest activities that has the real power to change things rather than necessarily the disruption.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some international issues. This is a story that's going to unfortunately make people nervous for quite some time. The president said over the weekend on Face the Nation, I believe, that he is not ruling out military action against North Korea. He is saying there is a chance we could have a major, major conflict with North Korea. I'd love to solve things diplomatically, but it is very difficult. When he says something like that, I believe Senator McCain said over the weekend as well, don't really listen to the words that President Trump is saying, just watch his actions, meaning that he may talk bluster at times, but really how he acts may be different. Should we be concerned about this? Do you worry about a major, major conflict with North Korea?
I don't think it's time to be concerned yet. I think, similar to Senator McCain's point, what experts who are watching the situation, like Elizabeth Saunders at George Washington University, will tell you is that a lot of what we have observed of Donald Trump's foreign policy is very superficial and for show, and that substantive actions have not varied as dramatically from the most part from previous administrations, right? The withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a departure with Obama, but by and large, Middle East policy, Asia policy, folks have made a lot of Trump's sort of harsh stance on NATO, but it was actually under Barack Obama that there was an explicit pivot toward more attention to Asia and less attention to Europe. And so it's not clear that there have been major changes, right? And so it's not clear that we should be worried about a major conflict with North Korea arising. Where I think there is some room for lower-level concern is that the administration's, I won't say refusal, but the fact that the administration has not yet filled, for example, a large proportion of staff positions mm-hmm. in the State Department, that may have some negative consequences at some point, inadvertently, essentially. And so I don't think that the public pronouncements, they are not setting off alarm bells for me, but I do think if we go on much longer without some of the more not as sensational, basic grinding the wheels of diplomacy, then there may be reason to become concerned in the future.
We're going to be welcoming phone calls. Our number for all things political is 800-486-8655. Be it the conversation over the weekend, what's coming up with health care, what the latest is on the Senate and House investigations, intelligence committees into the possible Russian connection between the White House aides and Russia. We are going to get an update on what's going on this week. The president invited the president of the Philippines, who's by all accounts not a very good guy. He has claimed, Duterte that is, that he murdered three people when he was mayor. And the National Human Rights Watch has made a case for a criminal investigation of the Duterte administration. So far, he said he's not going to come. But why would you extend an invitation to somebody like this? We'll take a brief look at the first 100 days as well. And invite you to be a part of the conversation. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to some phone calls. Let's start with Mason in Plum City. Hi, Mason.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Earlier on, you guys were talking about how the Democratic Party was possibly out of touch with the people of the nation. And I would just like to put it there that I believe the Republican Party is still out of touch with the people of the nation, too, because they did write off Donald Trump and just completely stopped backing him just before the election finished. And they were also trying to get him out of the race as soon as possible. So I think it's neither party is particularly in touch. It's just one guy managed to get people to follow him more than the other at this point.
So who is in touch, Mason?
What was that?
Who's in touch?
Well, I'd like to say somebody like Bernie Sanders was more in touch with his people. Trump has similar views, but they're quite a bit more extreme. So I think the Trump and Bernie Sanders viewpoints were what people were after, and because Trump actually managed to make it through the Republican area where Bernie Sanders didn't, for reasons I won't go into, I think that it's just more people felt like they were getting the truth from Trump than they were from anyone else. I don't think it was necessarily because he was Republican.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mason. Interesting points. Well, I think he makes a valid point. A good chunk of the American public doesn't think anybody's in touch at this point, Professor Beaulieu.
I think Mason makes some excellent points. And yes, we know that the number of people identifying as independent has been on the rise in recent years. And so, yeah, which suggests that there are a number of Americans who aren't feeling connected to either party. And the other point that I think is important to raise that is reflected in what Mason said is that right now, the Republican Party itself is intensely divided internally, much more so even than the Democratic Party. And so while it may be that for certain segments of the Republican Party, there was a close connection to Donald Trump and a close connection to those voters, there's another segment of the Republican Party that is different, that is distinct from Trump supporters.
I don't think I got an answer from you. Was it a sign of how out of touch the Democrats remain and not a wise decision for President Obama to accept $400,000 for a Wall Street speaking engagement?
I think that's tough to say, right, on a couple of dimensions. So one thing I would add to the perception of the Democrats being out of touch is we want to take into account that there may just be some winner effect for the Republicans, right? The Republicans capture the presidency and control both houses of Congress. And so that may appear to people being polled like they're doing a better job of representing Americans. And so we want to take into account that right now the Democrats are a little bit perceived as being losers, and losers are not seen as in touch with the American people. And if we think that the primary issue for Americans today is economic, then perhaps President Obama accepting a large speaking fee from Wall Street is problematic. But we've seen a lot of analysis come out of the election that finds other factors are as strong a predictor of support for Trump, for example, as concerns about the economy, issues related to health, issues related to racial resentment. So it's not clear to me that a former president accepting a large speaking fee is emblematic of the political party's distance from voters at this point.
And now that you mentioned the word health, let's talk about health care. Have the Republicans put together a very thorough health care 2 plan that will soon be voted on? The president certainly has urged that to happen quickly. It is very complicated, as we know from how hard it was to put together an Affordable Care Act, to put together something that will be a good plan and that everybody will agree on. When are we going to get something from the House on this? Soon? And is the president, do you think, actively involved in formulating a new health care plan?
I honestly don't know when we're going to see something, but my guess is not soon. And, or rather, I would say anything we see soon is not going to be much more than what we've already seen. And here again is where the internal divisions within the Republican Party become so crucial and problematic for them, quite frankly, because as folks like Sarah Binder at George Washington University have shown, when you have this high level of internal division, particularly on an issue like health care, you're going to have problems even within the Republican Party getting agreement on what something like a health care bill should look like, let alone then getting buy-in from Democrats, right? My impression is that the administration is currently about as involved as they were in the first round of creating the bill, which is to say not terribly involved. I have not heard of any more extensive efforts like those we know that President Obama undertook in the process of seeing the Affordable Care Act through. But it really is that internal division within the Republican Party that is posing the problems, because you have representatives with very disparate views on what a health care bill should look like.
Mm-hmm. And probably also a tax bill, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're running into this issue, which explains a lot, right? I mean, so on the one hand, anyone who's paying attention should be very perplexed that unified control of both houses of Congress and the presidency is not producing more prolific legislation, because there's really nothing to stop the Republicans from passing legislation,
yes,
except their internal divisions.
Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to All Things Political. We're talking about what the president is up to. We're talking in a moment about his invitation to the president of the Philippines. We're looking at the tone of the conversation and the fact that people are upset that the Democrats are not in touch with ordinary people as well. We're looking at this campaign-type rally in Harrisburg. We're also going to play a little clip from the Comedy Central's host at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Hassan Minhaj, and get your take on what both the president and Hassan had to say about the state of affairs. The Republican health care plan, are you looking forward to part two of a plan, and do you expect it sometime soon? There was an interesting piece in the Washington Post today, actually. I'm going to pull it up on my iPad here, that talked about how often the president has told lies, and it just outlined case after case after case. And yet that doesn't seem to bother his base. We also know that about 2% of the people who voted for Donald Trump regret their vote, so it doesn't seem to matter. What do you think? If you voted for him, what are you looking for? What promises has he fulfilled that makes you feel very happy that you cast the vote? What if he doesn't tell the truth? Is that upsetting? Well, we welcome your calls. And let's go to David in Madison next. Hi, David.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine, for your work with the League of Women Voters last week and also for your guest today. My observation and a question would be, with respect to the matter of the lack of genuine discourse, the lack of folks to able to discuss on what are facts, those kinds of issues about how to have an honest and open and real debate in the country on matters of concern politically, oftentimes, two things are mentioned. One is, well, get the money out of politics. I would agree Citizens United was, getting rid of that might help. Somehow trying to make some progress on reforming campaign finance. The other is the gerrymander issue, which we have now going to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Wisconsin gerrymander. That's the second thing. Those two are often mentioned. What's I never hear is something that would be a Wisconsin tradition and having served in local government in Iowa, I know that any time at the school board level, the city council level, if a majority of the legislative body holds any kind of a meeting, including even an email chain, then that has to be open to the public with the penalties if it's not. If that would be adopted with national legislation, we would no longer have the case where
Nancy Pelosi, if she's in charge, or Paul Ryan, if he's in charge, corral their so-called caucus. They all go behind closed doors for a day or two or hour or two, decide what they're going to do, and come out with a unanimous decision. We never hear what the internal debate in the we have to hope that some member after the meeting leaks something to a reporter. We don't, and that's why I think, as much as the gerrymander and the money of politics, we don't hear what's really going on. We don't really have the real give and take out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's walking meetings where some walk in and some walk out, and I hope your guests could shed some light on this other than to say, oh, no, it would never happen. Because, of course, that's not a solution. But I think if we could have open meetings for the, if it's a majority or more of the legislative body, it's got to be open with big penalties if it weren't. So thanks for commenting
on
that.
Thank you. Thanks, David, very much for your call. Professor.
David, I think that's a fantastic idea. I think that in general, we know, those of us who study the functioning of political institutions, that with increased transparency, we tend to see better behavior. We tend to see outcomes that are closer to the desires where we would essentially say in technical terms that agents will behave more in line with what their principals want. We, the voters, being the principals in this case, and representatives being our agents. With one caveat, David, I think that increased transparency is an excellent first step, but what would also be required is for citizens to be paying attention. And I do think there's cause for optimism there. I think that we talked about the marches earlier. I have been aware of congresspeople and senators fielding increased volumes of calls. There's been a lot of action around constituency meetings. And that increased sort of citizen attention in between elections around specific policy issues, I think, is another really important component. And so I absolutely agree that increased transparency, I think, will be incredibly beneficial to the democratic process. But it also will require the sustained and continued attention of citizens to have that transparency translate into the kind of meaningful pressure that would produce desired outcomes.
David, thanks so much for your call. We go to Suzanne in Mineral Point. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'd like to comment on the question of whether it was appropriate or not to invite for Trump to invite the head of the Philippines.
Okay.
And I go back to a controversial, surprisingly controversial interview Trump had with Bill O'Reilly, where he mentioned that nobody has clean hands. And we've welcomed the heads of China, Israel, soon I'm sure Saudi Arabia, and you could argue they have terrible human rights policies. And I'm still in favor of bringing George Bush to criminal courts for lying about weapons of mass destruction and all the Iranians, sort of basically, not Iranians, Iraq, all the lives lost there and basically destroyed their country. So while I think it's deplorable that he's presumably killed three people, I'm sure more, I just think the outrage for that is should be equally applied to these other countries.
I see your point. And the president has also said that he needs all the help he can get in confronting North Korea, that if it comes from the Philippines, so be it. This guy is a particularly dubious character, though. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, drug users, drug dealers, etc. And to have a mayor who claims that he killed three people himself, I don't know, there's something that is kind of distasteful about having him sit in the Oval Office, isn't there, Professor?
Well, so this is interesting. I think your caller makes an excellent point that a lot of times when thinking about moral issues surrounding human rights versus strategic geopolitical considerations, there is often thought to be trade-offs, right? And I do think that cases can be made for other world leaders having problematic records on human rights. Currently, yes, Duterte's record is questionable, but what I think is interesting is two things. You made the point, Kathleen, about the need for strategic allies in the region. I think that's one consideration. But I think another interesting consideration is that the way that individuals have come to be killed extrajudicially under Duterte is around a sort of campaign of cleaning up the country specific to problems around the drug trade. And if you think about some of the domestic platform positions Donald Trump has taken around, for example, why he feels we need a border wall with Mexico, right? It's to keep bad people out. It's to keep the drugs out. And so I think in some ways we may find the extremes that have we see in the Philippines as potentially problematic, but there is a sort of coherency in terms of a strong man taking charge and cleaning things up that resonates, I think, with Donald Trump and potentially with his supporters.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call, Suzanne. Our number is 800-486-8655. The Washington Post had a piece today on the numbers for the president's first 100 days, and they say this: the number of false or misleading claims made by the president in the first 100 days is 488. That's an average of 4.9 claims a day. Just to mention a couple here, giving himself credit for the January jobs report, even though the data was collected before he became president. The investment by Chrysler, which the company said was due to talks with unions in 2015. The General Motors investment also had been in the works. Jobs added by Walmart that had been announced in October. Jobs created by Intel, also created much earlier, boasted that he had personally negotiated a cut $600 to $725 million off an order for Lockheed Martin F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, but they had already planned those cost reductions. The list goes on and on. And yet, only 2% of the people in this country who voted for Donald Trump regret that. What is the role of truth in an administration? How does this president get away with so many false claims?
Well, I think a couple of things are going on here. So, unfortunately, as I believe an earlier caller alluded to, with the fact that politicians are not likely to endorse laws that would force greater transparency, our elected officials don't have a great reputation for being honest, right? We saw this play out in the campaign in really pointed ways. At that time, it was Hillary Clinton who was considered to be very dishonest, and Trump was the straight talker.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen since he took office, in the same way that, right, he was going to clean up Washington, except he's actually hired as many lobbyists as any other administration, or appointed as many lobbyists and folks from the private sector as any other administration, is a kind of acceptance that, well, okay, this is sort of how things work in Washington. So sure, he's maybe exaggerating what he's done and taking credit for stuff that makes him look good, but that's just what politicians do. He's learning to play the game. So I think there's that part of it that unfortunately politicians don't have a great reputation in this country or really anywhere for being honest, right, for being forthright. And so although the Washington Post can point out the places where he has said things that aren't true, the retort is going to be something along the lines of, well, of course, but anyone in his position would do those things or say those things. I think the other part to this, though, that you have alluded to with him not attending the White House Correspondents' Dinner is that he has set up an adversarial relationship with the press.
Oh, yes.
So that he's in a perfect position to discredit this, right? Sure, the Washington Post says I lie, but they're the dishonest ones. So we've got sort of a two-pronged where, although he positioned himself in the campaign as not a politician, there has now come to be this sort of gradual creep back toward what folks sort of accept as the price of doing business in Washington, if you will. And he has positioned himself as an adversary of the press and sort of vilified the press in ways that allow his supporters cognitive room to continue to support him even in the face of criticism like this from the Post.
Mm. And we'll hear some of his comments. Talked about that rally in Harrisburg, Virginia. He took on the press big time at that rally on Saturday. We'll hear a couple clips. Why not back to back? That'd be a fun way to listen to the president's comments about the press and then to hear the Comedy Central's Hasan Minhaj at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, his comments about the president. And we'll welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to join all things political. What about the House and Senate investigations about possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia? Where do those stand? Are those hearings going to pick up at any time? What does our guest know about that? Professor Emily Beaulieu is with us, and she is an associate professor of comparative politics in the Department of Political Science at the University of Kentucky. She's also an advisory member of Women Also Know Stuff, a database of female political scientists and experts. This is the Ideas Network, and this is First the President at that rally that we were talking about.
Now, before we talk about my first 100 days, which has been very exciting and very productive, let's rate the media's 100 days. Should we do that? Should we do it? Because, as you know, they are a disgrace. According to a Morning Consult poll, more than half of Americans say the media is out of touch with everyday Americans, and they've proven that. According to Media Research Center, 89% of the media's coverage of our administration has been negative and purposely negative.
And then, also on Saturday night, same time at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, these are some comments from Comedy Central's Hasan Minhaj.
Welcome to the series finale of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke. Now's the time to be a liar. And Donald Trump is liar in chief. And remember, you guys are public enemy number one. You are his biggest enemy. Journalists, ISIS, normal length ties. This event is about celebrating the First Amendment and free speech. Only in America can a first-generation Indian American Muslim kid get on this stage and make fun of the president.
Our next caller is Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi.
Your guest has already touched on what I was going to say. It's pretty obvious what Trump is doing. He's going to debase the press because the press actually has fact checkers, people who actually go back and find out whether or not an assertion that our president has made is true or false. So the only way he can defeat or defend himself is to discredit the very people, the Fourth Estate, whose job it is to hold him accountable. I mean, it's kind of obvious, isn't it?
Professor Beaulieu.
I'm inclined to agree, absolutely. I think what was interesting, Kathleen, in that clip of Trump speaking that you played was the statistic he cited about how overwhelmingly negative media coverage of him had been.
Right.
And that clearly is going to resonate with supporters who are already distrustful, right? But what I can actually tell you, because a number of my colleagues, folks like Kathleen Searles at the Louisiana State University, who code coverage as positive or negative is oftentimes what's being coded is simply the content of the reporting, which can even feature the object of reporting's own words. And so one of the things I'm so always curious about when I hear these statistics about how much negative coverage Trump receives is that oftentimes his own characterizations of the United States, of issues, is decidedly negative. And so when the press just simply quotes things he's saying, that is oftentimes going to register as negative coverage. And so it's amusing to me that then that he sort of will generate this content and then use it to make a very distinct point, that is, the press is out to get me.
Richard, thanks so much for your call. Jed in Baraboo. Hi, Jed.
Yes, good afternoon. I guess one thing I want to ask your guest is, after listening to all this, is the fact that I have never seen a president, and I'm 56 years old, at any time in the past that has suffered as much criticism as this president has since day one. Every day, in every way, in anything he does, literally in anything that happens in his office, the press has to pick it apart. Even if it involves his family doing something good or his family not doing something they should be doing, even his White House, his press secretary, or his Kelly there sitting the wrong way on the couch. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so when he's doing this press line report and he says it's a difficult job, I really don't understand why the man with all of his billions of dollars just doesn't say, you know what, everybody's so critical of everything I do every day, I'll just go back to what I was doing before because I certainly don't need the money. I mean, I was just curious as to whether your guest has ever seen this kind of coverage, daily coverage, of any president in the past as Trump is getting from the press.
Well, Jed, let me just throw something at you, and that's what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. The Washington Post had a piece today, and it's, you know, our right to know about this. They've been keeping track of false statements and true statements, and he has issued at least 4.9 lies every day since he's been president of the United States. Does that not bother you?
Show me the same statistics by the Washington Post of Barack Obama, of the Clintons, of Bush. You put them face head to head, the Washington Post and every other president that's been in the office, and then I'll go, okay, there's a problem here. But if the Washington Post only decided to do those statistics for him, then I have a problem with that, yes, because then they're singling him out. If you're going to put him on, give me all the statistics of all the five, six, seven presidents of the past and all their lies that they told and compare them with Trump, by all means, then let's see if there's an issue. Barring that, I don't believe it.
Professor, what do you think?
Well, I think you raise a really interesting point that I would broaden a little bit to, rather than general sort of criticism, to think about the ways that certain policy enforcement has been portrayed. And so the one that has really struck me is ICE enforcement activity, immigration enforcement activity, mm-hmm. right? There, I have seen a number of very pointed vignettes of parents being taken outside their children's school,
right.
People at the hospital. But the reality is, these kinds of deportation rates have been happened the whole time under the Obama administration. Obama deported more undocumented immigrants than any previous administration. And so I do think that your caller is onto something in that even when Donald Trump does things exactly like previous administrations have done them, they are maybe receiving some different treatment in the press. I would submit that part of that is because he is such a different figure than we've ever seen. So we may not have seen this level of criticism before, but we also haven't had a reality TV star turned president before. We've had, you know, a movie actor was the closest we came. But I think that some of what drives the heightened scrutiny is that he is this figure who lives so publicly.
Well, he lives publicly, and let's face it, the guy is not your normal president.
No.
I mean, he just isn't. He's the way he talks, the way all of the statements that he's made, the derogatory statements about women, the statements he's made about Mexicans and immigrants. I mean, the list goes on. He probably deserves some of that scrutiny because of the nature of some of the things that he has said. It's come out of his mouth.
It's true, but a number of the actual policies he's pursuing have just turned out not to be that different from what we've seen from previous administrations.
So you think he's learning to be president?
I wouldn't go that far. I just think that there is something to this idea that there's a disconnect between what he says and what actually happens.
Mm-hmm. Much as what McCain said.
Yeah.
Don't listen to what he says. Look at what he does. Jed, thanks so much for your call. Nancy in Glendale. Hi, Nancy.
Comment on the last caller.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
The last caller that was discussing comparing presidents.
Right.
There's no comparison. We have never had a president who tweets or who responds to the public the way Donald Trump has. So I don't think there is a comparison for this presidency. You can't compare it to anybody.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. He's a one of a kind. Mike sends an email that the caller who said that all politicians lie make it okay for Trump to lie over 400 times in his first 100 days makes Mike incredulous. Let's move to another topic. We're getting short on time. What's the story with the House and Senate Intelligence Committee investigations on Russia? Will they pick up this week? Do you know, Emily?
From what I understand, there is testimony that is set to go forward, but the overwhelming impression, so while I started the hour telling you about how Republicans in Congress are quite divided, I do think that there seems to be more unity around a lack of enthusiasm for really thoroughly investigating the situation with Russia's involvement in the campaign, which is not surprising. Even a fragmented Republican Party currently controlling both houses and the presidency probably does not see a great deal of advantage in vigorously pursuing what might ultimately undermine the current White House administration. I mean, the times in the past when we have seen more active investigations, it's been under divided government, mm-hmm. where one party really has more of an incentive to pursue actively seeking out potential wrongdoing on the part of the other. And I think here what we're seeing is a real lack of political will among congressional Republicans.
So you don't think we'll ever know the truth?
I think we will eventually, but I think it's very slow going, and I think this is one area where, again, we've seen that popular pressure on legislators has made a difference around things like health care, for example. I think absent similar popular pressure, it's going to take a long time to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd take another call, but then I'll get in trouble and we won't have enough time, so I won't do that. I want to thank you very much for being with us for our All Things Political segment this hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Thanks, Emily. Our pleasure to have you with us. Professor Emily Beaulieu, and she is a professor of political science at the University of Kentucky. We thank her for looking at a variety of issues. She is a professor of comparative politics and also is an advisory member of Women Also Know Stuff, a database of female political scientists and experts. Thanks very much to Colleen Duvall for producing this hour and to Colleen Leahy and Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Stay with us for the next hour of the show. We have spent a lot of time talking about Milwaukee because we're here in Milwaukee and looking at some of the issues with no jobs, high crime rates, etc. We will find out in a very personal way what's going on in the Central City from James Causey, who will join us hour two of our show. His series, A Worthwhile Read, both online and in the printed copy of the newspaper, So we will be looking at housing and crime and jobs and families and all of that following the news.